Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today I welcome back author M.R. Gogger to return to discuss more dark shapes and unseen entities lurking in the night. MR's book, Demons Among Us, has proved to be wildly successful since we last spoke, and we look into some of the encounters he's discussed from readers since its release. From the witch trial of Rebecca Greensmith, and the misperceptions of the witch panic in the New World, to attacks in the dark, we cover some of the accounts MR has come across, along with a look into the last attempt to prosecute somebody under the Witchcraft Act in the USA. We look at some unusual and unnerving accounts. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you early releases, ad-free episode, bonus content and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the show's channel on YouTube. You can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now we peel back the curtain to see if demons really are among us.
On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome back author M.R. Gogger. Since we last spoke, his book Demons Among Us has gone on to be a phenomenal success, hitting number one on several charts. It seems that an audience for the darker side of the paranormal remains undiminished. M.R., despite the weather, welcome back and thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to speak with you again.
Oh, it's one of those things when you do a show like this, MR, it seems like 5 minutes since we spoke, but it was nearly 18 months ago now, and a lot's happened since then, and obviously you're in the midst of a hurricane warning.
Well, I can't believe that time has gone so fast since we last spoke. I mean, it literally feels like yesterday, and to your point, yes, we are in the middle of a hurricane here in sunny South Florida.
Yes, well, it's a first for the show, so congratulations on being my first hurricane person during this. I've never interviewed anybody during the ramifications of this, so thank you for making the time in regards to all the personal circumstances you have.
Yes, no problem.
So, when we spoke, the book had just been released at the beginning of last year. Mm-hmm. Things were looking quite good. We dove into the topics, and then obviously, from that point on, the book just seemed to have exploded.
It's been a wild ride. The book has exploded. It did go to number one bestseller. But not only that, it reached number one in 10 categories when we did last release. That was number one in Ghost and Hauntings, a number one in Unexplained or Unsolved Mysteries, number one in Occult and Demonism, number one in Spiritual Warfare, and six other ones I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's quite a number one bestseller in many regards.
Yeah, well, that's always a good problem to have if you can't remember how many categories you hit number one in, my friend.
Yeah, that is a good problem to have.
So, was it one of those where it seemed to be word of mouth? Because obviously I know you've done a few shows since we last spoke. Yes. Is it one of those that it seems to have just gained traction and ironically taken a life of its own, MR? Or was it that it seemed to be one of those that because I know you've been on Coast to Coast a couple of times, and that's always a massive opportunity for anybody who's writing or working in the paranormal to get their work out to as big an audience as feasible. So do you think it was a combination of both, or it was a combination of some of the facts included in your book and the stories that you'd uncovered and the fact that you were shining a light on a lot of things that had been left behind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a number of things. I mean, certainly the coasts of coasts are instrumental in, you know, in driving them, because Amazon works with like an algorithm that no one seems to know how it works.
it is a paranormal thing in itself. Yes.
Right. Yeah. And, but yeah, I think it's a lot of word of mouth as well. I mean, but it's just catching fire. And people are reading it and loving it and seeing things they've never seen before or thought about it in ways they've never thought about, this realm of the supernatural and the paranormal. And so it's like seeing something for the first time and saying, oh my God, I've never seen that before. So there's a lot of that, and as well as those creepy encounters in the historical account of the first fully documented, case of demonic possession in American history, which we have spoken about on the show with you before.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, so it's, you know, so they're just, even though the book's been out for some time, they're discovering that there is some, you know, some really, really horrifying, creepy stuff going on in the paranormal realm.
I think often as well, when authors or investigators dive into a particular subject, it seems to be a catalyst for a lot of people to kind of reach out with their own personal experiences. And I can only imagine, knowing as little as I do about the paranormal, I'm still aware of how it works sometimes, that when an author comes out with a book such as this, MR, you will be surprised of the amount of people that reach out and say to you, well, actually, I can tell you something similar that's been happening to me.
Well, yeah, that was the most surprising thing about writing the book. You know, when you're writing a book like Demons Among Us, the whole time you're thinking, well, people are going to think I've lost my mind. people are going to think I'm crazy. And so when you put this kind of book out there, the biggest surprise for me was just how many people have come forward and said, you know, well, I have had this kind of situation and that kind of situation. And so I think Demons Among Us is one of those works where people realize, well, like, hey, maybe I'm not crazy. And, you know, because these things have happened to me, or I know these kinds of things have happened to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it really gave them a level of comfort to kind of come out and say, to reach out and say, yeah, I've had this happen to me and that happened before. And one of the most surprising things was my own mother. So she read the book and she goes, you know, I've had an experience as a little girl and I never told anyone about it. And so she told me a story. I'm not going to tell her story because it's hers to tell, but she tells me this story and I was like, oh my God. And I'm like, oh, how is it that you've never mentioned this before, but ever? You know, around the dinner table, maybe, or you know, watching a scary movie, or just never. So, I mean, it was just really, you know, a surprising moment when my own mother, it enabled my mom to share something she's never shared with anyone ever before. And it's happening with a lot of people as well.
Mm. I'm still surprised in this modern era, Emma, that obviously people like ourselves are quite open to having these conversations, regardless of the fact you may think that when you release the book, some people would think you were mad. But
yeah.
For us, these are normal topics of conversation. We're very open-minded. We can discuss a variety of subjects dealing with the supernatural and the paranormal and demons and things like this. Is it still one of those subjects that you think people dance around, that despite the plethora of books and YouTube videos and television shows that deal with these subjects, for a lot of people, this is still a subject they're not comfortable talking about in public?
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are still not comfortable, but I am surprised at the level of comfort now. And maybe that has to do with in regards to like all of the paranormal shows and all of the paranormal movies. I think that I'm absolutely completely comfortable talking about this stuff now, because at first I thought people were going to think I was crazy. And now that there's so many people and there's so many experiences out there, I really feel very, very comfortable speaking about this now. Partly because, it's so common, and partly because I don't care what people think of me. I think there's so many things that people have experienced and so many stories out there. I think it's allowed people to feel very comfortable now at this point. But of course, there are people out there who were still kind of afraid to come into the light, so to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you found yourself acting as a conduit for some people? Because I would imagine when you're dealing with a subject like this, you will get people who are actually going through this situation right now. There are still experiencing the thing and having these encounters, Emma. Is it the fact that as your knowledge and your contacts through the book have expanded, have you found yourself trying to assist people or talk over what's going on with people and offer them some guidance or put them in the right direction in regards to getting some help?
Well, I get a lot of people that reach out and say that there's something in my home, there's something attacking me. So it's in some cases, it's a very, very severe thing happening with a person with a very malevolent entity, either in the home, either attacking them. I mean, and they're asking me to pray for them, and which I do. And it might not be like with the person specifically. If they come in for a DM and they're like, I have this entity in my home and it's attacking me, you know, doing these things or whatever, then I pretty much immediately take to prayer for this individual, or I'll get, you know, people reaching out to me in that regard. And so I get a lot of those messages. I'm very, very quick to pray for these people, because I know that they're under some severe attack from an entity.
Mm. I suppose when you're dealing with these kinds of subjects as well, is it that there seems to be a wide variety of encounters that people are discussing with you? Or is there a set sort of template that seems to afflict more people than others? Or is it just there's no sort of rules to this kind of situation? People can have a wide variety of events occurring around them, all the types of attacks that they seem to be going through.
Yeah, it seems to be a wide spectrum of things, you know, because when we talk about the realm of the paranormal, the supernatural, there's a wide things happening, you know, behind there, where, you know, you have these entities appearing as this kind of form, or an invisible form, or bitings and attackings. And one was like, it was pulling my hair out. And there is a wide spectrum of events that are happening to people. And so in the paranormal has a wide spectrum of elements, meaning, you know, from Bigfoot to UFOs to, you know, to dark spirits and to, you know, to glowing lights, to ghosts and monsters. So, I mean, it really, the paranormal really runs the gamut. And I hear a lot of things from a lot of different people they want me to talk about as well.
Well, yeah, often you've got to be careful what you wish for, because you can find yourself overrun with all kinds of strange encounters encompassing all kinds of aspects of the paranormal. And I think it's one of those things, when I spoke to other authors and investigators, that I don't think they're surprised, but I think sometimes it's almost as if they've burst the dam, MR, and that all of a sudden people just flood them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they probably experienced some of the stuff that I experienced as well. I just think people, you know, when they see that people are investigators or someone like myself, I think it gives them a level of comfort to think, well, I can reach out to this person, or this person's not going to think I'm crazy, you know?
Yeah. You'll actually take the time to listen to them and try and understand what they're going through, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of empathy for it, because 99.9% of the times they're really not crazy. They are dealing with something of the supernatural. You know, so I definitely don't cast these people off as, you know, as crazy. I believe there's things happening behind the scenes that most people aren't aware of. So I don't think that they're, you know, at first glance, I won't think that they're crazy. Now, don't get me wrong, there's some crazy people out there. But when it comes to this kind of stuff, I don't think the crazy things are really happening behind the scenes, you know?
Yeah, I think often as well, without people being churlish or dismissive of people that are having such violent encounters.
Yeah.
That for a lot of people that are going through these things, when they realize that there is someone like yourself who will listen to them and take them seriously. And as you say, you can't accept everything you're told, because there will always be people just creating fantasies for attention, or sure, they have other issues at play that sure can sometimes cause these kind of situations to manifest in whichever way they're trying to describe them. It still, I think, allows these people, because you've got to understand that these people, they can't talk to their family, perhaps sometimes, as you've been referring about your mum. Even yeah, their closest relatives or the people that they love, they don't feel comfortable enough to be able to explain or open up about what they're going through. So I think on top of everything else that they must be experiencing, that must be so hard for a lot of people.
Well, it is. I mean, because it's for some, it's a very, you know, personalized thing. And if you're getting scratched and bitten and your hair pulled out by some dark force that you don't know what it is, invisible dark force, and you don't know what it is, well, where do you take that information? Right? Like, okay, well, who do I talk to about this? Because this is some pretty scary stuff, right? And so there are those, you know, we're talking about highly malevolent beings. And so they do some very, very heinous stuff to humanity and to individuals, and people really know where to take that. So they internalize it. And first they say, well, maybe I was imagining it, or I thought it might be this, or I thought it might be, you know, something other than what they thought, you know, or so anything other than a demonic creature. You know, they think of everything else, but, you know, and then finally things get so out of hand that they're, you know, I think they internalize it and they don't know where to go or who to talk to. And so I think I'm one of those people where they're like, well, this guy will listen, you know?
Have you ever come across something that, even with what you've written about and the people you've spoken with and the investigations that you've done and the research, Emma, have you been informed or come across a situation in the last sort of 2 years when you've been doing this and dealing with the book and the promotion of it that's shocked you or surprised you or made you think, dearie me?
Yeah, well, it's crazy because, like, you know, you hear people, they have their stories and they, you know, so I've heard various stories. I was like, well, yeah, I've seen similar things or experienced similar things. But then when you get people who come and they're like, there is no doubt a demon or some kind of dark force in my house, and it's doing, you know, and it's doing this, and it's biting and it's scratching and it's choking and it's pulling my hair out, and I'm pulling my hair out, and, you know, these very, very dark things. Those things I find very surprising, because, you know, they kind of come out of the woodwork, you know, and you're like, whoa. You know, so you read this comment, or you feel the call on another show, you know, on other shows and stuff, because these people are in torment. These are malevolent creatures that torment people. And so these people, they're in such torment, they don't know like what to do. So it does sometimes take me by surprise. The level of torment that people are under and that they've been suffering. And so that has taken me by surprise.
I think I often find it quite frustrating sometimes that when you deal with a subject like this, for some people, there seems to be a set rule book for these kind of attacks. And yet I've seen enough and read enough to know that for some people, it starts off very gradual. It's little things going off in the house, funny noises, seeing things in their peripheral vision. Some people, it's 100 miles an hour straight away. They go from sleeping well to being attacked in their sleep. Is it one of those frustrations about this subject MR, that it seems that, as with a lot of things in the paranormal, too many people try and frame them as, well, this is what this type of situation is. Whereas, obviously, when you're dealing with these subjects, it seems that there's no rules. Anything can happen.
No, there really are no rules. I mean, the common denominator for most of these cases is that there's some form of the occult that they were tampering with, and they didn't realize what was behind this stuff. So when I talk to people, you know, of course, the usual suspects are Ouija board and, you know, and tarot readings and spiritists and trying to conjure the dead. And so when people start tampering with these occult practices, they don't realize that there's malevolent demonic entities behind these things. And so, and these entities, they look at it as an invitation. So it really acts as a doorway. And so when you would try to kind of expel these things or you want to get them out, and they would say something to the effect like, well, I was invited and he or she wants me here, right? Because you've opened what they look at as a doorway or an invitation into the life. And there is no rule book. I mean, it does graduate. It does go gradual. You know, first it usually starts with an oppression or oppressiveness or heaviness that you just can't seem to kind of shake, or, you know, and then it develops into like harassment, meaning that you'll start experiencing some demonic manifestations or being woken up with terrifying dreams.
Hmm.
And, or it graduates to, you know, the things of like chokings and strangulations and, you know, and just things. And it just kind of seems to escalate. So there is no real rule book. I mean, you know, they can come hard and heavy, or they can just do it gradually, you know, but I think there are some openings. And so when these things are happening to people, I always ask like, what is in your life that may have invited these things in? And there was always some form of thing. Well, you know, my mom was a witch, or, I was practicing, you know, this, or I was always some form of occult practice that usually comes into play where they, when they think about it, they're like, oh, that could be a doorway.
Hmm. Have you come across anybody that believes that something's been sent to them rather than them accidentally inviting it in, MR? Or is it just often people have, as you say, offered an invitation on the spiritual plane, whether they realized it or not? Or do you still get, as some people say, a curse or something like that, that they feel that someone has deliberately sent something?
Oh, yeah.
Something towards them.
Oh yeah, that absolutely happened. So when you talk about witchcraft, that entails employing demonic spirits to do your bidding. The thing with witchcraft is the witch believes that she is controlling demons when in fact the demons are controlling her. Or the warlock or those practicing witchcraft, right? Casting those spells, the demons don't work for people. they start to take tighter and tighter grip of someone's life, right? And so, I've had things cast on to me, and so it is possible that people have had things sent upon them as well. So, yeah, that does happen for sure.
I suppose in those kind of situations, what's the kind of remedies that people can try and utilize to rid themselves of these visitations, whether they've accidentally invited them or had them sent to them, then, MR? Is there a specific channel for people to kind of deal with these kind of issues? Are there people that they can reach out to?
Yeah, well, you're dealing with very supernatural things, and it's not going to be handled by any natural sort of means. And what I mean by that, you're not going to be able to burn enough sage to make these things go away, or you're not going to be able to, you know, any of these other sort of things, you know, these little charms or trinkets to keep them away, not even crosses. And when it comes to overcoming the supernatural or these demonic entities, you need someone whose power is greater than those in these the demonic in the demonic realm. And that comes in the form of the man Jesus Christ. Only he is greater and more powerful than these beings. In fact, he says that to his followers, he says, I give you power to trample on snakes and scorpions and all the power of the enemy. Now we have an enemy of our soul. And this is what these demons are. And the power that Jesus gives his followers is the authority that he gives over these creatures and beings that we don't have any strength over in our own natural sense. But he has given us this supernatural power to drive these demons out. And when I have these experiences that come to me in the middle of the night, it's only his name. So I employ his name. And I've seen these demonic powers, these dark shadow figures and demonic beings, they kind of like melt like a mist when you call on the name of Jesus, and when you utilize the authority that he's given you over these entities. That's the only way I believe that has true power over these dark forces. And if you are a follower, it doesn't mean that you're not going to experience these things, you will, but you have a greater power now because he has given it to you to defeat these things.
Mm.
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Do you think these reports are just constant, or do you think that we have situations where these reports sort of fluctuate, that there'll be occasions where they seem to be more prevalent, or do you think it's just a constant level of attack that goes on and it's only people brave enough to come forward to talk to it? So these are always going on. It's just who's brave enough to step out of the shadows and say, I'm being attacked by a demon, or I'm being visited by some entity that's wanting to damage or hurt me.
Yeah, I think it's going to be increasingly worse and worse as the days go on. And because there's a scripture in the Bible, it says the devil has come down with great wrath, knowing that his time is short. If I believe we're coming into the last days, where we're either in the last days. Now, as the last days draw closer, then you're going to have a hell-bent devil with demonic forces trying as hard as they can to harm humanity and to harm individuals. And so I think you're going to see an increased level of activity that as the days go on.
Do you think it's dismissed too often as a cliche that these attacks happen at night more often than not? Am I? Because obviously we're well versed enough to know enough about these kind of situations to know that they, whilst a lot of them do go on at night, obviously some do happen in the middle of the afternoon, for example.
Yeah, I'm sure stuff happens in the day. It's my personal experience that everything I've ever experienced was always in the dead of night, whether it was being choked with steely, invisible hands, whether it was being woken in the middle of the night at 3:33 a.m. by a disembodied voice and seeing something at my bedside. And that's in the book. That story's in the book. But everything has, for me, has happened in the dead of night. I mean, just woken up out of a sleep, or in that kind of like quasi, you're not quite asleep, but you're not quite awake mode.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a lot of that as well.
Do you think that's because that's when we're our most vulnerable?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't quite put all the pieces together about why it's the middle of the night, but I think it has to do with when we're the most susceptible and that we are the most vulnerable. I think that there's something to that.
I think when you look at the book and the work that you did, obviously, when you were last with me, we were diving into the Elizabeth Knapp story. But obviously,
right,
your book is chock full of strange encounters and first-hand reports. So
yeah,
for you, is there a particular experience or story from the book that it has stayed with you since you wrote it? Or is there something that you've developed more knowledge about, or you've had a sort of follow-up based on what you wrote?
Well, I think that one of the things that really kind of resonates with me and as resonates with the readers and as well as the listeners is when I talk about the first experience in hearing the voice of the demonic. And I don't know if we covered it last time, but I can say it again. I can tell the story again.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So one of the times, the first time I heard the voice of evil or a demonic voice, whether it was Satan himself or Lucifer, or if it was another demon, I don't know. But it had happened once the moment I became a follower of Jesus Christ, I went to try to pray for probably the first time ever. And I don't know what prayer looks like. I don't know what it sounds like. I don't know what I'm supposed to say or what I'm supposed to do. I have no idea. I'm fresh off the boat, so to say. And so I was like, all right, I guess you get on your knees and, you know, and so I do that. And as I start to pray for what is most likely the first time ever, I sense something come into the room, a real dark, unnerving presence. And I know it's evil. And it moves right up behind my right ear and it just stays there for a second. And I'm like, and so I know it's there. And I scrunch my shoulder like backwards to kind of like shirk it or shoo it away, you know? And then right after that, I hear a voice speak directly into my ear. And it says, "You may have gone to God, but you belong to me. You will always be mine. I will never let you go." And it was as clear as day. And the funny thing about the voice is Hollywood has a real way of making you believe that it's, you know, monstery and hoarse and gravelly. The voice was just the opposite. It was actually smooth and silvery and baritone, and even had an air of royalty or regalness to the voice. As very, very placid and calm. But underneath that placid, regal voice, you could sense the cunning evil that was just beneath the surface of that voice. It was like this undercurrent of underbelly of evil as it spoke. And that was the first time I heard the voice, the audible voice of evil for myself.
Was it something that you think was because that you had decided to start to pray? Or do you think as that voice was trying to say, it had always been with you? Was there a period of your life where you had indeed yourself opened these doors unwittingly or maybe unaware of? Or do you think that it was always lurking, but by going to pray for the first time and enter into that, it saw that as an opportune moment to make itself known to you?
Yeah, I think that when we live our lives outside of the governments of God, we live our lives under the principles of Satan and evil and unknowingly. And so that's the thing. We just kind of think we're like living our lives and just doing our thing, but we are governed by the principles of evil and influenced by it without even knowing it. So you don't have to bow down to a statue or sacrifice, you know, a child and worship a, you know, a horned being, you know, in the middle of a pentagram to be under the influence of Satan or evil. You just have to be out of the governments of God to be under the influence of evil. And so I said all that to say is that when I became a follower of Jesus Christ, that means you become an enemy of evil. And so you get a target on your back. And so the moment that you decide to become a follower of Jesus Christ, you now have an enemy that's going to stand against you and resist anything that is good or godly or holy or right or righteous or anything of that sort. You now have an enemy against you. And that's what had happened. It was like you changed teams, you change armies. you know, and now you start fighting against the one that you actually served in, right? Unknowingly, you know, I had no idea I was under the principles of evil and of Satan and under that influence until I got under the governments of God. It's like these scales come off your eyes. And so what happens is, yeah, you just become a target now of evil.
Hmm. Is there a tried and tested manner in how to deal with this kind of affliction or infestation that occurs? And is it one of those, I think often as well, people can sometimes misidentify maybe their location more than anything. But often I think some people fall into that trap of just presuming, even as flippantly as moving house or changing cities or doing something like that, that they'll leave whatever it is behind. And often that doesn't happen, does it?
No, I don't think that's an answer many times. I mean, because, you know, I think that evil follows you, right? If you're in the grip of a demonic, if a demonic force has you in its grip, you don't, location doesn't matter because it has its grips, it has its claws in you. So it doesn't matter where you move, that you're always going to be under the influence of this entity if you don't, if you don't come under the government of God and take hold of the power that is in Jesus Christ to expel and drive these things out from your life, you're going to have this grip always in your life. It's always going to have a stronghold. It's a military term. It's always going to be a stronghold in your soul or in your spirit. And it's always going to have access to your life if you don't change teams and come to Christ.
So when you speak with people, is there any sort of guidance that you give them, MR, or is it a case of you will point them in the right direction often? Or for some of these people that come forward, is it often the fact that they're just unburdening their experience that allows them to be able to deal with these situations more positively? Because obviously these are very traumatic on whatever level you want to look at it, and take their toll on people, both physically and mentally.
Yeah, it does. It's exhausting. I mean, it's exhausting for people, because it's an unending thing for them, you know? And it's very, very burdensome, and it's frustrating because you can't break free from it. I think that people do feel comfortable on unburdening their souls. I can lead these people, you know, to the water, but I can't make them drink.
Mm.
And that's partly why I wrote Demons Among Us, was to really kind of, not only share some really creepy personal and historical stories, which the book does really well, but also to open the eyes of people that they might see what's functioning right behind the realm of the invisible or the unseen world, right behind the curtain of the paranormal, that they would not see otherwise, to just really kind of like sound the alarm to all these things that are happening behind the scenes without them even knowing it. And they might be influenced by it and not even know it. And that's why I wrote the book, because, you need people to show you, you know, you need people to kind of like expose these things. And that's what the book does.
Yeah. I think as well, I know obviously the first time we spoke, we discussed the incredible case of Elizabeth Knapp.
Yes, we did.
And the fact that, as I said at the time, I was stunned that this seems to be one of those experiences that had just been left on a shelf for 300 years.
It's 300 and some years. Yeah.
But I think one of the other incredible historical stories that you uncovered in the book was Rebecca Greensmith.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. Once again, these are things that when you read the stories, as we discussed about Elizabeth Knapp, it blows me away when we have such an appetite for the paranormal and stories of this nature throughout history, MR, these particular stories seem to just get left behind, and certain other ones seem to just carry on regardless forever. As we were saying, because obviously Knapp occurred prior to the Salem witch trials, everybody knows about the Salem witch trials and everything that went on there.
Right.
But nobody had heard of Knapp, and Greensmith seems to be another one that has completely dropped out of historical knowledge, and people just don't seem to refer to this case. And yet, it's as remarkable as what happened to Elizabeth Knapp.
It's truly terrifying. I mean, it is a truly, truly one of a kind, truly terrifying story. that had happened to this young girl, this 16-year-old servant of the minister, Samuel Willard. And it is truly, truly terrifying. And it starts, you know, as you know, the story starts to peel like an onion as to, like, you know, what happened to this girl. Was she serving the devil? Did she sign the devil's book, like so many others did? And was she in the service of Satan? Was she a witch? Why was this happening to her? And that's what the book starts to kind of reveal once you get deeper and deeper into the story. It's actually chapter two. Once you get into deeper into this story about, you know, Elizabeth Knapp, but to the story of Rebecca Greensmith, going over to that, many people think, especially in America, that Salem was the first witch panic, which it wasn't. The first witch panic was in Connecticut, and it was 40 years before the Salem witch trials, which leads us to the story of Rebecca Greensmith. And that story goes, there was a woman by the name of Ann Cole, who was a very godly Christian woman of the community. And she started to have these trance-like kind of visions.
Mm-hmm.
And she would kind of go into this trance. And in one of these trances, she started to hear this conversation of how these people were going to ruin her life. And it turns out she wasn't hearing people. She was actually hearing the voice of these demons in a discussion, or basically a round table of how they were going to destroy her life. And they were talking about destroying her marriage. They were talking about soiling her name. They were talking about trying to get her out of her good standing with Christ. They were talking about how they were going to ruin this woman. And then they were coming up with all these ideas, and they said, well, who are we going to get to do this? And lo and behold, she overhears the name Rebecca Greensmith. And so she, after she kind of comes out of like this trance, she tells her husband what she had heard. And then the husband goes to the town minister. And then the town minister goes with two other gentlemen to the prison in which Rebecca Greensmith is held on other witch charges.
Mm.
So she's already in prison. And so when she's confronted with these things, she confesses that it's true. And then she confesses that she's a true witch. And she confesses not only that, but she starts to just kind of like unburden. And she's like, yes, I am a true witch. I held these witch meetings in the woods with other witches in the town. And she would drink sack, or it was a form of wine at that time, and dance around fires, trying to conjure, you know, with the spirits, conjure spirits as well.
Mm.
And then she confessed that the devil first appeared to her in the form of a fawn, and that after about three or four times, then it started to speak through the fawn to her. And then after that, he would appear as a man, and she confessed to having sex with him regularly, which she described as it was both repulsive and ecstatic at the same time. And it was because of these confessions that led to her execution, which was one of the first witch executions in American history, and it took place outside of Hartford in the Hartford Square. At that time.
Mm. I think one of the things that shocks me most about this particular case is that it seems that her husband wasn't really implicated in much until Rebecca said that he'd been involved.
yeah.
Which is one of those aspects that you think, well, was she just hoping that if they were both accused, it might be better for both of them? Obviously, if anybody looks into this, it doesn't end well for either of them.
No, it does not. Yes,
but
true.
But when she's asked why she's done it, she says, because I love him.
Yeah.
And I just found that remarkable that she would put her husband in that situation, because no, as far as I'm aware, Eman, you might correct me if I'm wrong here. He didn't seem to be implicated in anything or seem to be doing stuff. Or if he was, he was on the fringes of it all. And everything seemed to be revolving around Rebecca and some other members of the community.
Yeah, that's true. No, that's absolutely true. But yeah, I don't know why he wasn't so much more named in it than he was. But yeah, that's what's one of those historical mysteries, I guess.
Yeah. It is often some of these things. I mean, there's a case recently that I've been aware of for a while, but not to so much of a depth, which occurred in Scotland with a gentleman called Thomas Weir, MR, who was a very powerful member of the Covenanters in Scotland and a deeply religious man, or so his impression to the general public was. And that all goes horribly, horribly wrong to a level where you think this can't be real. And then you look at it and what he admitted to in his 70s, I think he was. And to say it's eye-opening would be an understatement.
Right.
But he's one of those people that he'd been accused of consorting with the devil 20, 30 years before it all came out.
Oh, wow.
And someone that had actually accused him was flogged in the streets for lying.
Wow, because he was so influential?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So it doesn't surprise me, because it's around the same period, that sort of late 17th century era, and yet here you have two very similar situations on opposite sides of the Atlantic where these things are seemingly running amok, as it were.
Yeah, that's yeah. I don't know if they were, so much like running amok. It's like you just have like these stories like on both sides of both continents that they weren't so much as common, but they were so extraordinary in the sense that it's a polarizing thing, that these stories are so extraordinary that they that they outshine, or they just become these enigmatic stories because I guess that they're so outlandish and they're so extraordinary. But it's not like it was happening to everybody, but you do have these sort of singular accounts that are so extraordinary. It makes you think that it's happening all over the place, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think the other strange thing about this particular case is that when we look back at that period, as you've said there, and I think often when people look back at this particular period in history, they think people were being hung as witches all over the place. And it wasn't happening to that level. But
no.
This seems to have been the last time that anybody was charged and hung for being accused of witches in Connecticut, which it, once again, is one of those things that it's kind of dismisses this cliched version or view of that historical period that a lot of people have, especially in the New England area.
Let's face it. I mean, there's lots of people accused that weren't witches. So, you know, and then there were thousands who died in Europe and in England. They created a guy, what was his name? Matthew Hopkins.
Yes.
Who was the witch master general. So he's just kind of going around saying, yep, you're a witch. And you have a mark on your flesh, and yep, you're a witch. And
yes,
you know, so when you get a guy like that going around saying every woman's a witch, and he wielded incredible testimony. Thousands of in Europe, and it was Germany. In Germany, they not only burned you at the stake, they cut off your head too.
Yeah.
So it's like they, you know, so there was there witchcraft? Yes, I believe so. Was rampant as people think it was? No. I mean, you know, I think, you know, just take the case of, just take the Salem witch trials. Well, not everybody was a witch. In fact, I think 19 people who were accused died were not, especially Rebecca Nurse. She was a godly Christian woman in her 70s or so.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then at the end of it all, you have the girl who accused people, almost all of them, Ann Putnam, who confessed at some point in her life that she lied.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get a guy like Giles Corey, he wasn't hung, but he was pressed to death with stones. They just kept putting stones on top of him. And he said, more weight, right?
Yeah.
You know, and because he was innocent, you know? And so, so there was a lot of innocent people who died in the, in the witch panics, not just in America, but also across Europe as well.
Mm. It is odd. I mean, Salem is a big example of that, that it's straight. I mean, we can look at it and not necessarily find it amusing, but I find it baffling that often in these cases, it would usually be children that would be the main witness of the prosecution, MR. I know in Greensmith's case, it was her next door neighbor who apparently didn't like her.
Yeah.
So it does show you sometimes that if we just accept things like this on face value, I think you miss a lot of it. And as you say, a lot of the implications of what went on in Salem and other such situations, there was clearly some animosity, some kind of agenda, as you were referring to Matthew Hopkins, who was renowned as just pointing his finger at anybody who didn't like the look of you. If you looked at him funny, you were a witch.
That's right.
Another such accusation. So it just shows you sometimes that even the most trivial of disagreements can lead to terrifying circumstances and implications in regards to it all.
Yeah, it's true. And it really just started a panic. And, thank God that there's people like Samuel Willard around.
Mm-hmm.
He was instrumental in stopping it and arguing against, he took a very, very moderate view towards it, because it was his experience with the Elizabeth Knapp case that afforded him the influence and the authority on this at the Salem witch trials.
Mm.
And so, he argued that spectral evidence wasn't sufficient enough to convict on a witchcraft charge, which was a capital crime.
Mm.
You know, as a matter of fact, in that period, it was better to be named a murderer than a witch.
Yeah.
And so he was really concerned about the stain it would put on somebody's reputation, because he knew that having a, even if you were deemed innocent, it ruined your life, because it stained one's reputation forever. And he knew this. And so that's why he took such a moderate, stance and approach, and he tried to stop these things, trials. And so he wasn't so much caught up. You know, it's possible for any of us to get caught up in a panic, whether it's a witch panic or a medical virus panic. Right.
Yeah.
And so we tend to think that, like, oh my God, these people must have been so dumb and gullible that they were caught up in this thing. But, here we were all over the world wearing masks. So everybody kind of is capable of getting caught up in a kind of a panic.
Yeah.
And so we're no different than them. And so, but thank God that there was Samuel Willard. There was, who was the guy, the Oyster and Terminer guy who came in, who was like a lawyer. So between, the cooler heads of Samuel Willard and the lawyer at the time, they were finally able to stop the witchcraft trials,
Mm. Mm. I mean, I'm often surprised as well, because over here, they were very clever, MR, in regards to it, because they weren't allowed to torture people.
Mm.
But making somebody walk all day was not classed as torture. So you could make somebody walk for 24 hours a day and it wasn't torture.
Oh, wow.
But obviously, if you're being forced to keep walking in your cell for 24 hours a day, I think very soon you'll admit to anything, really.
Of course. I mean, that is torture. Yeah, you're not getting flogged, but it's still a form of torture.
So it's very strange how they would sort of circumnavigate the law often to get the results that they wanted. Mm. As we've said, and Salem is a paradigm example of that. We had something very similar here in Scotland, especially under King James, who once again is another one who saw witches everywhere.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at spinquest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit spinquest.com for more details.
Of course he did. Yeah. And he wrote, you know, and he literally wrote the book on it. Right. And because of his experience, he thought that, you know, his wife, what was it? His wife fell overboard or she was killed right after their honeymoon, I think.
Yeah.
And so he blamed it on witches and he thought that there was some kind of witchcraft at play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And absolutely. So, yeah, I'm sure I'm mangling the story, but I'm close.
Yeah. 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 It's strange that, yeah, yes, it was a tragic event, but
yeah,
I think with the greatest respect, that is a leap of faith that leads you into all kinds of trouble when you start to presume that that's the reason it happened.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So I don't know what exactly all of the specifics that led him to think that it was just only witchcraft, you know? But apparently must have thought so pretty strongly to write the book on it.
Yeah.
But again, there's some real cases like in Ireland and Scotland that I really want to start delving into. I haven't had to get a chance to delve into them. But I did have a good chance to delve into the Pendle trials, which was fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of them as well, because it's one of them when you look at what they were put through, you know, marching them 65 miles.
Oh my God.
On foot to Lancaster, where they were tried.
Right.
Even in this day and age, that's not a good walk, you know, even with good shoes on. Emma,
no,
you know?
Absolutely. I'm sure they didn't have any shoes.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. It is. Yeah. But it's the witchcraft history is absolutely fascinating. Whatever side of the pond you're on. Right. I mean, it's just, it holds a fascination inside of us for some reason, like this dark, it feeds some sort of dark thing in us that we just can't get enough of, you know?
I think obviously with the success of the book and how it's led you, no doubt this has now opened up other avenues and projects that you've got on your horizons now. I would imagine, because as we said the last time we spoke, to stumble across the Knapp case,
yeah,
and you were diving into those yellowed parchments.
Oh, yeah.
Blowing dust everywhere.
Yeah.
So where has your research or your writings taken you now? What are you planning to sort of carry on investigating such encounters or experiences, or have you kind of taken it to a different direction?
Well, I've gone in a very, very similar direction, speaking of witchcraft and witch trials. And it was because of the level of historical research that I put into the book, into these other witchcraft cases. I actually have a script right now, a screenplay that I wrote. It's a full feature, full feature length film screenplay. It's modeled after real witchcraft cases, and it promises to be probably the most terrifying, true to life witchcraft witch trial you could ever put on screen. I can't say ever penned, but I do know that the level of research needed to bring that to life, it's going to be a fascinating piece of horror for sure.
Mm.
So right now I'm looking actually for producers or agents to get to kind of get on board with it and see if we can get this onto the big screen. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm really excited about this project.
Ah, fantastic. So is that the case of looking at your research to construct a terrifying case for us all?
Yeah, I mean, this comes from directly from all the research that I delved into. You know, when you do a case like Elizabeth Knapp, it leads down lots and lots of rabbit holes, and so it leads to witchcraft cases, and it leads to witch trials, and it, you know, and things of that nature. And again, it's a period piece. It's set in 1655, and so it's probably the most true to life witchcraft trial you will ever see, and it's very, very haunting in its telling. So I'm excited, and you know, hoping to get some people on board with me to get it done, and but it's surprising. There's lots of twists, and it's probably going to be like a horror that we've never seen before.
And I think often, as we've touched on there, it is something that even in this modern era, we talk about these things that are 300, 350 years ago. There still seems to be a real appetite. I don't know, like you say, regardless of which side you come at it, whether it's a fascination with witchcraft in that particular period of time, or it's looking at the ludicrousness of some of these accusations that were made and the characters that were using this as some kind of tool to promote their own personal positions in the church or the community, MR. It's a strange thing, isn't it, that we still have such an appetite? And if anything, it's probably more popular or has more of an interest for people these days on a variety of levels.
Yeah, it's like a weird thing. I guess it just feeds into some innate thing in our human nature. I don't know what exactly that is, but people are just, this is just fascinating to people. And so, you know, and I thought to really tap into that fascination, and, you know, and craft this story, this film, to tap into that dark fascination, and to give a glimpse into that period and to see how haunting and how harrowing the trial actually would have been.
Yeah. I think what surprised me as well, I think the last time we spoke, I had a dive into American witchcraft trials, and I was really surprised to come across a lady called Lucretia Brown. And once again, this is one of those things where we talk about fascination. This was the last, as far as I'm aware, this was the last witchcraft trial that was brought to court in the US, and it was in 1878.
Yeah, crazy.
And this is all to do with somebody having a bad back, you know?
Fill me in on the story. I'm all ears.
So there was a pair of sisters, I think, called Lucretia, and I've forgotten what her sister was called, but she got a bad back and she fell into a sect of Christian Science.
Were they in Louisiana or some southern state?
No, it was in Salem.
Oh, it was Salem. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
You got a story you haven't read across. But yeah.
Well, I'll send you the link later. So,
please.
So she basically had this bad back, and she believed that she'd been cured through this Christian Science sect that she'd become a member of.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had a relapse, her back went. And so the woman that ran this particular sect convinced her that the reason her back had gone was a neighbor had used psychic powers to bring the illness back.
Huh.
And so this woman who ran this branch decided that they would prove that this man was a wizard or a witch.
Yeah.
And they tried to take him to court. However, nobody else seemed to take it seriously because he didn't even turn up in court. I think he got a wonderful name, like Spofford, this chap.
Yeah.
And he just went, no, this is rubbish. I'm not doing it. But it all, once again, as we were saying, it all turned out that he used to be a member of this Christian Science group, and they kicked him out.
Wow.
And then it seemed that this particular, I've forgotten her name. Is it Mary Eddy? I think it was.
Mary Baker Eddy?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So she was the Christian Scientist, but I know I'm very familiar with Mary Baker Eddy for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know much about this story.
Yeah. So she ended up getting everybody in the congregation to basically claim that this guy was a witch.
Wow.
And so everybody that came to court that she called as a witness was in her congregation.
Wow.
So she tried to write articles about him, slagging him off in all the press, and a lot of papers wouldn't print them. So then she went to court and then told the congregation that they had to think bad thoughts about him.
Wow.
And then eventually she tried to take him to court, claiming that he was psychically trying to injure people. And eventually it was thrown out because they said that they just didn't take it, that it had any validity at all, and it just seemed to be some kind of persecution dressed up as superstition. And eventually it was thrown out on a technicality because they said that the case just wasn't very good.
Yeah, well, how do you prove that? I mean, it's very, very difficult to prove psychic involvement in these kind of cases.
Absolutely. Well, the judge said that it wasn't in their power to control Mr. Spofford's mind.
A good ruling.
Absolutely. So I'll send you a breakdown of that, because it was one of those stories I stumbled across, and I thought the next time I get a chance to speak to you, I'll mention it, because I'm sure it's right up your street, that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love stories like that, for sure.
Yeah. So other than the script, anything else going on for you, my friend?
Yes, I'm finishing up on my audio book, because people keep asking me for the audio book. And so I am in the middle of, I'm almost done with that. It's been going on for quite a little while. So I apologize for anybody who's out there and was waiting for it. I know I keep saying it. I feel like George R. R. Martin with the latest, Game of Thrones book. but yeah, it's coming. And, we're very, very close, to finishing. I'm finishing the last of the recording. And much of it has been edited. So we're working towards it. I can't give you a date, but I know it's coming out. It's coming out soon.
Fantastic. Excellent. Any more books in the pipeline?
Yeah, absolutely. I got a few on the burner, but one that I'm really, really excited about. I can't give away all the details, but it's a horror for the ages. And people keep asking me if I'm going to write Demons Among Us 2. I say, God, I hope not, because that means I have to experience more demonic things.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah, careful what you wish for there. Careful what your readers wish for, surely.
Yeah, but I'm always writing, and I have a lot on the, in the pipeline for sure.
Fantastic. Well, listen, it's been lovely to catch up with you. Where can everybody find you online and get a hold of a copy of your book and follow your work?
Well, you can find it on Amazon. Right now it's discounted. The Kindle version, I think, is just $3.77. So it's very affordable. And you can get the print version as well. And I will have it available in other platforms. That's coming soon as well. And you can reach me on Instagram at m.r.gorga and at Facebook at mrgorga.
Brilliant. Well, listen, it's been lovely to catch up with you. Glad to hear that you and everybody close to you are safe and sound after everything that's gone on in the last few days over in Florida.
Oh, yes.
You take care of yourself, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future. And thank you so much for joining me as always.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's always a great time speaking with you. Appreciate it.
SpinQuest Social Casino. It's Thanksgiving time. The turkey's hot and the family's loud. Instead of football, play a different game on your phone. Live dealer blackjack, craps, and slots. Play anytime, anywhere. SpinQuest.com. This Thanksgiving, gobble up a $30 coin pack for just $10. Come play today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.